You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Marilyn. And I want to thank all of you for taking some time to come out and enjoy a little pre-Christmas festivity with me. So, I want to tell you, we're going to be doing a kind of a multimedia presentation. So let me get my sound up, my sound level up first. There we go. Okay. Now it's going to be too loud. But oh, you just did it over there? All right, we're not in too bad shape anyway. Okay, so just a little information. For those of you that want to know or read a little bit more about my work, I've got a web page, and I also have an email address. I will post this again at the end of the presentation. And if you want to read more about this talk tonight, well, I certainly don't want you to pay any attention to the man behind the curtain, but please do read the book. And you will find it out there and also available on the website. At various locations like Amazon.com and so forth. So we're going to be talking about the subject of the soul. And we're going to be presenting this and quantum physics. And we're going to be presenting this, you might say, it's one physicist's vision. It's by no means the only vision of the soul, as many of you know. And it's not necessarily, maybe not even a unique vision, although I haven't been able to find much like it in modern literature. I've been able to find something like it in very ancient literature. I would say that that's a good place where we're going to start our modeling for the soul. So, the big problem. What is the big problem? Well, that's the big problem. How are we going to have this conversation? And that is a problem. You can say that again. So what would happen if you could have a conversation with God? What would you say to God? Well, one of my fans said this. You've got to convince me that you know what this is all about. You're not just fiddling around, hoping it'll all come out right in the end. As you see, I'm a movie buff. Well, being here on the planet Earth is really being in a very strange place when you think about it for a moment. It's this vast infinity. Vast. I mean, it's so vast that it's beyond vastness. And the question is, why am I here? And why is anybody here? And why is it that I'm in this unique position of being able to know that I'm here and that maybe somebody else is here and this is not just all a figment of my imagination? I'm not so sure about that. Very possibly everything you see and hear now and forever may be just a figment of somebody's imagination. We don't really know, but we want to talk about what kinds of problems in life we have here on this planet called Earth. So I decided to study some of the deepest philosophy I could find dealing with the problems we have here on planet Earth. And I found that the deepest philosophy I could find was from the words and the pens and the work of the great and only English philosopher Monty Python. Now, Monty Python did a movie not too long ago called The Meaning of Life. Maybe some of you saw that meaning. And there's a wonderful scene in which a bunch of characters come to the home of person, Mrs. Brown, and they strike up this conversation with her when one strange being happens to walk out of the refrigerator. And they say, "Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, revolving at 900 miles an hour. It's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned. The sun, which is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at 1,000,000 miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of a galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 60,000 light years thick. But out by us, it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding, universe. Our universe itself just keeps on expanding and expanding in all the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, because it's bugger all down here on Earth. Thank you. A little warm-up. So what is a soul? What are we talking about here? What I want to do is I want to try to present a very narrow vision of the soul, which I think helps explain some of its mystery. At the same time, not too much of its mystery, so it's completely explained away. That's the trick. The problem with science is that it seems to leave out things like mystery. The problem with spirituality is it leaves out explanation for anything. I mean, ultimately, if everything is, well, God did it, well, that means that ultimately I'm not responsible, or human beings are not responsible for anything at all. And if anything that seems to be happening to us as time's passing right now, so we're beginning to sense that maybe we're a little more responsible for stuff than we ever thought we were before. And maybe all this learning we're having, all these things we're beginning to understand, this greater ability to reach into the heart of the nucleus of an atom or into the great cosmos which we live in, maybe that ability to do so is something that is really God-given. It's something that we really should have. It is not something we should be running away from or be afraid of. And maybe that's a necessary part of what is consciousness. Yet, each of us has this experience of, here we are. What the hell did I do to deserve this? I've fallen into this planet Earth, seemingly from God knows where, and here I am. And many of us may have that experience of just being falling into a space. Well, I seem to have a soul, but what about devices? Can a machine have a soul? I mean, is that really possible? Is it I think, therefore I am? Can my computer have a soul? Is it possible? What about Data on Star Trek? Data's greatest problem when he first came on the show was trying to become human. He was like the in The Wizard of Oz, this character, the straw man who wanted to have a brain, or the lion who wanted a heart. All these are characters are sort of like, well, you know, reminding us of something very unique that we seem to have, that Data doesn't seem to think he has, but yet the rest of the crew thinks he has. What about the idea of losing a soul? Can a person lose their soul? Is it possible that a soul can just be taken away? Is it possible that we can lose our soul? Well, in a certain sense, the answer seems to be yes. And we want to try to understand, well, how can somebody lose their soul? What would that mean? I mean, we've had operas about it. What is it, Faust? The opera Faust is about essentially losing your soul. A new television series right now called Brimstone deals with a person who's essentially trying to get his soul back by coming back to Earth and sending bad guys back down to hell or something like that. Whatever it is, we're pretty concerned about this thing. And we wonder, well, did Hitler have a soul? I mean, do bad people have souls? What about the soul? What? How can we understand it any better? Well, in many situations called tribal, or we use the language third world, or more primary people, tribal people, the notion of soul loss is very, very real. And they have the sense that indeed the soul is something which needs to be pulled back in, it has to be regained. This is from a movie that was made by a film director, a Peruvian film director, who's a friend of mine. It's called The Winds of Ayahuasca, and it deals with a young woman who is a prostitute in the town of Iquitos, which was badly devastated by people coming in and attempting to take rubber out of the jungle, and then later and turning it turning a very small sleepy little village town into a almost a metropolis, and then suddenly everybody leaving and leaving the people destitute when they decided to plant rubber trees in the Philippines. And many people got lost and lost their souls. And this shaman is attempting to bring the soul back in. Is this a possibility? Do we need to worry about such things as soul loss? And then, of course, we have this part of life. Oh, Brad, you are my soulmate. This whole notion that somehow I'm not complete, that I am only part of the picture, and that there's something else, some other being, that if I could find her or him, that person will complete me, and then I will have my soulmate. But then there's also the question that we are all faced with constantly, almost on a daily basis, especially today, as we're listening to to what's going on in the White House, and what's happening with censorship and this ship and that ship, and whether we should, you know, impeach the guy or just hang him by the ears, or what should we do with him? Meanwhile we're doing so well financially, we almost feel guilty even worrying about the fact that he has three affairs or four, whatever he had with some young lady, and we're all ready to take this guy and hang him. I mean, see, the rest of the world wonders where's our head? Why can we think about this way? What are we thinking about? I mean, sex is sex. I mean, to make such an issue of it. But, you know, we're Americans. We believe that there are certain things they make an issue about. So we have this good and evil. It's always with us. We're always, you know, dealing with fighting it, fighting off the evil and trying to be good. And then we try to be as good as we could, and our kids think we're as evil, no matter how goody-goody-good we are or whatever. And this constant battle goes on. Well, what about good and evil? Can we answer questions about that from the point of view from an enlightened or a new vision of the soul? As you see, I like movies. This is an old movie, Charles Boyer, Ingrid Bergman, Gaslight. What? What's that? No, it's Gaslight. I believe it's Gaslight. What is it? Definitely Ingrid Bergman. It's not Ingemar. It's definitely Ingrid. And he's the epitome of evil. He's supposedly going to murder her or something like that. And you can see how innocent and good she is. So we have these aspects that the good, the innocent, and the sinister, and the dark, and, you know, light and good, and dark and da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, we go to movies because we enjoy this pull, this sort of like polarization, which takes us from one side to the other. It makes us, gives us a chance to identify with one character or the other. Well, really, you know, in each of us, both characters exist. What about hell? Well, in the shamanic world, the notion of hell is a very real situation, a very real thing. When people need healing or when they need to confront their demons, often they have very hellish visions. These were done by a young Peruvian painter who worked with Jose Luna. I forgot his name, unfortunately. But these were taken, these were painted after taking the drug ayahuasca, which is kind of a soul cleanser. I spent some time with Peruvian shamans and have taken ayahuasca. And when I saw these pictures, I immediately said, yeah, that's Guess what? That looks pretty real to me. So if you want to have these kinds of experiences, ayahuasca is the drug for you. Anyway.
Is that the one they call yagé?
What?
Yagé?
Yake, yeah, yes. That's different kinds of it, right. Well, what about the Buddha? How did the Buddha deal with the soul and the nature of good and evil? Did the Buddha have much to say about that? Well, there's an interesting aspect of Buddhahood. The Buddha didn't believe in a self necessarily. I've used this as a picture of the kind of the Buddha presence and the notion that I want to talk about in this lecture about soul and self. I want to try to explain what those are. That we have this little self, this little character that you see at the bottom down here, and this big one here, which we might call the soul. You might say that we're in a constant dialogue, there's a constant conversation that's going on in us all the time between soul and self. Sometimes we recognize it, and a lot of times we just don't. But Moritz Escher captured this notion of good and evil as somehow one is the background for the other, that you can't have one without the other, that no matter how you try to make an absolute good out of it, you're just going to be doomed to failure because there will always be the background. Jung talked about the shadow aspect of ourselves. So I think this is an interesting highlight, the black demons and the white angelic figures. Maybe some of you didn't even see that right away, maybe some of you saw the Rorschach black and didn't see the white background, or some of you saw the angelic white and didn't see the darkened background. But this is sort of indicative of this endless conflict, this resolution in us. You might say that this is a kind of a process which seems to be very necessary for consciousness itself, is that we have these constant distinctions between good and evil. Well, how are we going to come to an understanding of the soul based upon quantum physics? Where is that going to come from? Well, it's very natural for any physicist these days to go back to the ancient Greeks, because the Greeks were kind of like the first peoples to think about the universe as a whole rationally. This, of course, was their big mistake. But nevertheless, it was a very noble effort, and it's led us onto the path of, you might say, our Western culture. It starts really with these fellows. They, you might say, had a faulty foundation stone for the soul. We might imagine this is, I think, Raphael's painting of the school at Athens. Maybe some of you have seen it before. There are some characters around here. We're going to look at them a little in just a second or two. This is Plato and Aristotle, and that down there is I believe it's Heraclitus. Here's a little closer view of them. We can go a little bit closer even. And here's Heraclitus, and he's taking notes about what Plato's talking about. And I wonder what he's going to think of next. I mean, you know, students typically worry about these kinds of problems. I'm sure Heraclitus had his problems with Plato. And here they are, the great Plato and the great Aristotle, the student and the teacher. And Aristotle is the first one to offer the soul is the body's way of moving. And that's the first primal definition. If something's moving on its own, it's got to have a soul. So the soul is what moves the body. So we have to find, what is it that moves the body? But we look at Aristotle, and he comes up with a slight different twist on it. He says, but it's immortal. Whoa! I mean, the body is certainly not immortal, and Plato knew that, so did Aristotle. And Aristotle wants to, I mean, this is a very big, this doesn't look like a split, but it turns out to be a fairly major split. It's almost like the beginning of materialism, where here we're talking about idealism. You might say this is the ideal material split beginning to take place in this very simple two statements made by teacher and student. Well, what could possibly be meant by the soul moves the body and is immortal? Well, one of the arguments goes back to the notion of something called a prime mover. We might imagine a string of dominoes. And that at the very end, domino X, which is off at infinity somewhere, is supposed to be the prime mover. And so if X suddenly were to topple and fall, well, it would knock over the next one in line, which should then in turn knock over the next in line, which should in turn should knock over the next in line. They all should come tumbling down, provided X is the one that started it all off. But the big question would be, well, what about what came before X? This is an old chicken and egg argument that the Greeks certainly knew about. The question is, well, what got X moving? What started it? What was the prime mover? What was behind X? So somebody comes to the point, well, if X is the prime mover, if it's the start, then it somehow must have moved under its own force. It wasn't just knocked over by the next one in back of it, because there's nothing in back of it. It's at infinity. So this got into the whole problem of the dialogue of what could be meant by something which could move other things but not be capable of moving itself. And then we have the big mystery connected with the soul. Not only is the mystery of what animates the body a mystery about soul, but we also have this big question, the concept of death. And we all have experienced death somewhere in our lives. And what happens at death? Is it, whoopee, yahoo, I'm out of here? Is that the ultimate experience? Or possibly there's some greater mystery, some magical dimensional tour in which up is down and down is up and right is left and left is right, and possibly we're going to go to another world in which we have these kinds of experiences. These are all possibilities. And then there's another question which I think we are all being faced with today, especially living in a crowded city. How many of them are there anyway? My God, I mean, there sure seems to be a lot. Well, it turns out that there might be a very simple answer to this question.
Everything's clear now.
Just one. What if only one soul, and yet all of these presences that we call beings or bodies, each thinking very seemingly clearly that each one has a separate soul? Is a possibility that there's a unique oneness that's present that we call the one soul? And can we, from that point of view, explain our own very existence? Well, it turns out that that is the place that grabbed my attention when I began to investigate a model for the soul from the point of view of quantum physics. But I found I had to go pre-Greek. I had to go before the Greeks. I had to go almost to prehistory, to the time even before the Egyptians, possibly to the Chaldeans. But we'll start with the ancient Egyptians, to see if we can find a reasonably good foundation stone for a definition of the soul. Well, Egypt is, of course, the magical place. It's filled with all kinds of wonders, from the Sphinx to the pyramids to all sorts of things. And of course, as we know, the Egyptians paid a lot of attention to the notion of death. And one of the things that the Egyptians were very conscious of was a kind of a cyclical movement, which can be almost seen in the story, but not quite. Here we have a character. His name is Ani. He is a scribe. He's been taken by Horus, the son of Osiris, into the chamber of Osiris after his death. On these scales, his heart is about to be weighed against the feather of truth of the goddess Maat. And if everything balances out, he gets to spend eternity with Osiris. But spending eternity with Osiris isn't necessarily what you might think it might mean. Because it turns out Osiris is the color green. And Osiris's green color is very significant for us because it is the spirit of rebirth or regeneration. So there's implied in this story here, which there's more details which I haven't told you about, that somehow when you die, you're going to be reborn again, that there is a continuation which will go on. In all of the stories, the same thing is basically told to us. Here's a close-up picture of this balancing of the heart versus the feather of truth of Maat. And here we see the color of Osiris, the color green. Well, what is the story? How does the story go? Well, there's a certain aspect about soul which the Egyptians recognized in the sense of they had this notion of the ka, or the double. And the ka would guide the soul at the moment of death on its journey. So in other words, when you die, some ka is going to come to you which will guide you to where you're supposed to go next. And there's a lot that you have to know. In the ancient Egyptian mythology, you had to know a heck of a lot when you died. You had to really, like, practice. You had to know your secret name. You had to know where you were going. You had to know the names of all the gods. And you were constantly being interrogated before you got through all this. But nevertheless, once you passed through this, the notion was that there would be a regeneration, a kind of a rebirth. So before I come to this, let me just complete that thought. This notion of a rebirth has to do with the first inklings that the Egyptians saw when they recognized that the sun rose, and the sun set, and then the next day it rose again, and that there was a cycle to the sun. And they associated everything they saw with that cycle, including the notion of soul. They saw the soul as something which rose as the birth of the sun, and they saw the sun set as not the death of the sun, but the movement of the soul into the netra world, or into the world, the dark side of the world, where it still moved and came up again. So in other words, the soul, like the sun, ever continued. And so they basically had this notion. Well, where did they start? What was their basic concept? And the answer turns out to be an idea which is very, very old, at the same time, very, very new. It's called the vibrations of nothing. And the idea that there could be vibrations of nothing is a very strange idea. And we're going to be talking about that to some extent. First of all, there is in Kabbalah a symbol for this vibrations of nothing. We call it Aleph. It's the first letter of the Hebrew Aleph Beit. And it turns out, just like it's what it symbolizes, Aleph is a silent letter. It has no pronunciation of its own. It represents the beginning letter, the A letter, for many special words. For example, Ahava, meaning love, begins with Aleph. Elohim, meaning God or gods, begins with Aleph. Ish and Isha, man and woman, begin with Aleph. So we have many words which are representative of this special Aleph energy, whatever it means. Well, the Kabbalists had a kind of an intuitive notion about how all these things were connected together. They saw water as being something very special, which acted as a kind of a resistance to movement. And they saw that Aleph, like God, would breathe. And in breathing, the breath of God, which is symbolized by the Hebrew letter Shin, would move into water, forming bubbles, which would be particulate-like, trapped spirit, if you will. Well, this notion of particles of matter being trapped spirit is very similar to some ideas from modern physics today. We now think of particles as being little trapped strings of vibrating nothingness. And so this idea is not so far-fetched. It's a very ancient idea. It's also a very modern idea. And they also saw, remember I told you about the Ka who guided you. They also saw that there was a duality. There was a two-ness to all of this breath. The Aleph would breathe an out-breath, which would go into the waters, making bubbles. Waters represent consciousness and coming into consciousness. And then the breath would, after it came to the surface, would bubble back out again and return to Aleph. This would be the cycle of life-death. And this would also be the cycle in which not only is life and death created, but the whole material universe comes to being through the same basic cycle. There's one key element to it all, one extremely important element to all this, which is extremely mysterious in all of this. There's resistance to it. There's something which opposes itself in opposition to this breath of God. Even the waters themselves act as a kind of resistance. Consciousness itself is a kind of resistance. In quantum physics, we say that somehow all the different possibilities pop as a result of some kind of resistance into consciousness.